Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today's episode of The Main Course has been brought to you by Fairway Market. For more information, visit www.fairwaymarket.com.
Welcome, everybody, to The Main Course. I'm Patrick Martins. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Jack, are you there? Happy St. Patrick's Day,
I'm
Jack.
I'm here, yeah. I escaped for St. Patrick's Day yesterday.
Yeah, we didn't leave Brooklyn. But actually, my name, Patrick Martins, is actually the French Patrick. So I'm sorry to break it to you, Dorina. You agreed to come onto the show as a... thinking you were being interviewed by an Irish guy, but... So you did not go to the parade, Jack?
No, I actually went upstate by Pleasantville to a lake.
Wow, you left the city.
I left the city, yeah.
It's unlike you. Well, it's been a big week for us, Jack. We've essentially been kicking it into gear because the federal government just awarded this station nonprofit status.
We can give ourselves a hand for that, right?
Yeah, it really means that we are serving a social good and an educational purpose, and it's a tribute to our hosts.
And our archive.
Yes, well. And the archive, for sure. And your work. I mean, that's everything. Well, we're going to celebrate it all on Tuesday, right? There's a big...
Wednesday.
On Wednesday.
Yes.
Thank God. I will change that in my schedule book. And Wednesday is a celebration of shows that have... had over 100 episodes.
That's right, yeah.
And how many are there's like 10 shows of all of that
like
category?
10 that have either hit it or are about to. So
give us an example of some of the 10. Which is the oldest?
The Main Course was the first to hit 100.
You're
congratulations
talking to it.
Yeah,
all right. Others?
The Farm Report was next, and then we've got Beer Sessions. Unfiltered hit 100. Erica Wide's The Naturalist is about to hit 100, which is so incredible.
100 in more ways than one. Bernie is turning 100. No, that's going to be fun. And where is the event, Jack?
It's at Santos Party House, which is like West Broadway and Lafayette, maybe, or right around there.
And how do our listeners RSVP?
Right on the website, heritageradionetwork.com. Right on the left, where our news is, there's a link to buy tickets. So,
oh, fantastic. Yeah. Heritageradionetwork.com. And it seems like Jimmy's just done a fantastic job. I mean, he's filled up the place with food and people. I mean, it's close to getting sold out.
Twitter was flooded with advertisements for our party, so that's good.
Very, very interesting. Well, this is going to be a great show. Actually, this is going to be one of the great shows. We have Dorina Allen, who's going to come on right after the break. But listen, Jack, my intros are not usually that good. They're all over the place. No 2 weeks are the same, and they never improve upon each other.
That's why people can look forward to them.
Yes, that's why people, you never know if it's going to be a shit show or if it's going to be, really organized introduction. Well, I do want to just say two things. I was in Costa Rica for a couple weeks, and there were some very, very sad zoos being run there. And I'm a big animal rights activist. My whole business, Heritage Foods, is about treating animals, the way they deserve to be, especially if we're going to eat them. But I would like to look into, Heritage Foods and this network, being behind some cause. I'm sure there are a lot of people doing this out there already, but I think zoos should be run by federal governments or, by the state, 100% of the time. You can't just have a business guy deciding to bring in exotic animals and you trust that guy to be correct to the animals. So anyway, that's one thing. And I was talking to my English friend who was on the show last week, and there were all these sheep. He sent me pictures of his home, and there were all these sheep on these public lands. And I think that's a great cause also for the station to take up or other people to take up. I'm sure there are people doing it already. But, American public parks should be populated with livestock. I really believe that. In San Francisco, they have bison roaming the park there. And I kind of like that. It seems like there would be a lot to gain, from having pigs or sheep or goats, like in Central Park in a sectioned off field or something. Kids can come and visit them. All right. I'm off my pulpit. We're going to take a break and come back with the Julia Child of Ireland, Miss Doreena Allen.
Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market. Whether you are cooking for one or for a crowd, Fairway Market literally has everything you need for a fantastic meal. But if you don't feel like cooking, no worries, they cater. Check out fairwaymarket.com for more information, and be sure to check the new blog, On Our Plate, for weekly specials, health tips, and recipes.
Going to pronounce these Irish names correctly. All right, I was just joking with Doreena that I am worried about screwing up these Irish names. But Doreena Allen is our guest. We're really super honored. She was born in Call O'Hill. Yeah, she's an Irish chef, food writer, a TV personality, and founder of Ballymaloe Cookery School in Shangagary, County Cork, Ireland.
I think I'll have to translate.
Yeah, thank you. I'm sorry. I'm really butchering this. And even though it's the French Patrick, I still am embarrassed for all Patricks that I'm mispronouncing these so badly. Doreena has been called the Julia Child of Ireland by numerous groups, including the San Francisco Chronicle. Doreena is the award-winning author of 14 cookbooks on Irish traditional cooking. We're going to talk about a few of them, but one of them that I really liked is the Forgotten Skills cookbook. And now most recently, Irish Traditional Cooking, which features over 300 recipes from Ireland's heritage. She is Ireland's most famous TV cook, having presented 9 series of her cooking program Simply Delicious on television around the world. Well, thank you so much for coming out here on a Sunday, Doreena.
Oh, well, it's a pleasure.
So tell us about your most recent book and, you know, how it's different than the books that came before it.
Our Irish Traditional Cooking, which is published by Kyle Books here in the US, this focuses completely on Irish food, and it's everything from the food of from what the hunter-gatherers ate right to the food of the poor people living almost a subsistence existence, to the smaller farms, etc., right up to the fantastic food that they ate in the country houses, in the aristocratic families. And many of them had, you know, kitchen gardens, they had their own cooks, they had orchards, lots of spices. I mean, they made full use of spices, salt and aromatics. So really, it was fantastic what they were eating. So when people think of just corned beef and cabbage, there was so much more there.
There really was. So now this book has a little bit more history in it. It's more fun to read. Like I was reading this section on the pork. The early Irish pig was thin, scrawny, and vicious in temperament. Yes. Until medieval times, pigs were fattened on mast, the fruit of beech and oak, which was said to give the flesh a delicious flavor. After the widespread adoption of the potato, virtually every home could afford to rear a pig because the animal could be fed on the surplus potato skins and sour milk. So this book is filled with kind of like interesting insights into the country.
Absolutely. And as you say, quite a bit of food history in it, and all about our food culture and our traditions in Ireland right through the ages. And it's different from my other books. You know, the Simply Delicious books were the early ones were about food that was simple and delicious. It was all about getting people into the kitchen and encouraging them just to look around, get some lovely fresh local ingredients and cook something. And the recipes really worked in it. So it really gave people confidence and so on. And then the Ballymaloe Cookery Course, which is a great big one, was sort of goes more or less with the cooking school. And then Forgotten Skills, the last one, that one was all about reminding people of so many of the skills in cooking and so on that were forgotten, preserving and everything. That
give us some examples.
Oh, well, there was, you know, everything from how to fillet a fish, how to make a piece of bacon, how to pickle, how to make butter. And because this cooking school is in the middle of an organic farm, we have, you know, we produce a lot of our own food. We have three Jersey cows, which we milk every day. So we teach the students can, if they want to, learn how to milk a cow. You'd be amazed how many of them do. I always say you might never need to milk a cow again, but it's, you know, it connects you with how food is produced. But and it looks good on a CV. It certainly gets the conversation started if you want, you're applying for a job and it says can milk a cow. And then they separate the milk from the cream, a beautiful Jersey cream, make butter. The students make butter every day. We make butter at the school apart from on Sundays. And then we also make cheese and yogurt. So, you know, there's all that sort of connection.
Now, these Simply Delicious books, was it kind of like fast food for a working country, you know, that they could just come in, cook simply and fast without ordering in? And is there an infiltration of fast food there? I mean,
yes, there is, but it wasn't all about fast food. It was just about real food, whole food, nourishing food, and showing people that, you know, you don't have to go out of your way. Just look and see what's in your garden, what's in the area. It could be you can make a wonderful meal out of potatoes and cabbage. You can make a wonderful cold cannon and have a big lump of Irish butter melting in the center. So it was about taking good ingredients. The whole message was take good ingredients. And then if you start off with really good, naturally produced, well, local food in season, then it's so easy to get it to taste good. But if, as we all know, if you start off with mass-produced, denatured food, then you have to be a magician. And that's where all the twiddles and bows and smarties on top come in when you're trying to, you know, compensate for the flavour wasn't there in the first place. So that message went through all of those television series and everything. And people used to say to me, which was a lovely compliment, that after they'd watched the programme, they felt like jumping up out of the chair and running into the kitchen. So it gave a lot of people confidence. And then, as I said, the recipes were very carefully tested. So when somebody did it, it actually worked.
Right, very good.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk at the last segment of the show about the Irish history and traditions, but just a little bit more so people understand exactly who you are. Now, you started a cooking school, the Ballymaloe.
Ballymaloe is
a cooking school. It's also kind of like a hotel.
Well, we have we're a four generational family. So there's Ballymaloe Country House Hotel, which is what you call an inn, and then there are some restaurants and cafes. And then we started the Ballymaloe Cooking School in 1983, and that's in the middle of a 100-acre organic farm. So we have an acre of greenhouses, and we have, you know, our own pigs, our own chickens. You'd love it, actually. Our own cows and all of that. So, and gardens, extensive gardens. So there's all of that. And then students come from all over the world at this stage.
We're going to talk a little bit about the school now for a bit because it's really fascinating. But you said gardens.
Yes.
So tell me about Mike. Is that how do you pronounce it? He's been your gardener for 50 years.
He's just retired, but he was. But quite a lot of people who are working with us at Ballymaloe have been. That we have another man called Joe, who was originally a shepherd on the farm, and he's been with us for over 60 years now.
A shepherd? What's a
shepherd? Looking after the sheep.
So really, yes. And they would go from field to field in the old days.
Yes, and then we needed a bit more help in the dining room, so you know he put on a suit, came up, and you know gradually learned, and so he's been with us for over 60 years. So a lot of our staff have been with us for a long time, and then we have people coming in and out and interns and so on as well.
Now you have a 12-week certificate course and also now tell us about that, and then you also have day-long courses. So
yes,
this is for tourists or people who live in Ireland.
Yeah,
right?
Well there's the 12-week certificate course. That's a really intensive full-on course for people who want to use their cooking skills to earn their living, and people literally come from all over the world. There are 10 nationalities there at the moment, and we have one teacher with every probably six students. The first thing we teach them on the first day is we teach the first recipe they get is how to make compost. Mm-hmm. And then the first thing I do is introduce them to the gardeners and the farm manager and say, these are the people who are growing and producing a lot of the food you're going to be cooking with for the next 12 weeks. And it's taken Eileen there or Holly 12 weeks to grow those beautiful beets or carrots, and don't you dare boil the hell out of it when you get into the kitchen. Mm-hmm. And then we walk through the gardens down to the farm, and the first thing we show them how to do then is how to sow a seed. Mm-hmm. And they plant a little plant into the ground, and then they watch that growing for the next 12 weeks. And it's like, this is a really important lesson, because they suddenly realize how long it takes for something to grow. Mm-hmm. And that it has to be looked after and watered, or an animal has to be fed and all of that. So it gives them a real respect for food and the people who produce it. So that's really important for me.
What is the curriculum? I mean, do you teach classic French technique?
Everything. Our basis of what we do is the sort of food we serve at Ballymaloe, where the menu is written every day depending on what's there and what comes in from the boats and so on. But basically we also have, you know, Mexican influences, Italian influences, Indian, etc., etc., from all over the world. We can dip, I think, but the main thing is the all the ingredients come in fresh. So we make breads every day, fish, starters, and everything is done from scratch. The mm-hmm. the meat is butchered, we make butter every day, and yogurt and cheese from the milk of the cows. And then also we fill it, the fish comes in whole, so we fill it. So it's really about connecting the 12-week students particularly with how food is produced. I wouldn't, if I had my way, I'm such an old whatever, I would not let anybody, chef or cook, into a restaurant kitchen unless they'd spent time on farm or in a garden. Mm-hmm. So they really knew how food is produced, were really connected, and had a real respect for not only the ingredients, but also for the people who spent their lives producing this kind of produce for us, and the farmhouse cheesemakers and the artisan producers and so on.
Well, take us one step outside of your immediate school then. Talk about, I selected these two foods, the fish, because I know that there's a group of fishermen that you work with directly, and cheese. I know there's a huge renaissance of cheese in Ireland. So can you talk about, is Seamus Sheridan?
He absolutely, the Sheridan brothers are iconic in Ireland.
So start with cheese. Tell us about the renaissance.
You know, one of the most interesting things that's happened on the food scene in Ireland in the last 30 years has been the emergence of the farmhouse cheese industry and also artisan food production, basically. So it started really when we had a surplus of milk, when there were subsidies in the EU and people had a surplus of milk, then a lot of few women, particularly farmers' wives, said, we can't just throw this out, it's beautiful milk. And they started to warm the milk and make a little cheese in a very, you know, sort of experimental way on their kitchen tables and so on. And the people like Veronica Steele, who made the Malines cheese, Jaina Ferguson, who makes the Gabin cheese, and many others. In fact, now one of the early ones made Cashel Blue, made by the Grubb family in County Tipperary, is available over here, as well as the Irish butter and all of that. So they started to make raw milk cheeses, and it grew from then. And they had a wonderful, always the cheesemakers and the artisan producers, they seem to be really feisty characters, really interesting people. I'm sure it's the same the world over. And so they were very generous with their information, taught each other. And out of that then has come, for all of us, this really wonderful produce, these farmhouse cheeses, often made on the farms and called by the name of the farm as well. So they have a real taste of that place, of that pasture. Of course, in Ireland, we can grow grass like nowhere else in the world because of our climate. So a lot of our best produce, our beef and our lamb and our dairy products, come from our grass, and there are no hormones. The cattle are automatically fed on grass, pasture raised, as you call them over here. So the quality of our butter, which is now widely available, Kerrygold is widely available over here. It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's just what we are. It's not something new. It's how it's always been, always will be, the grass feeding of the animals. It's there. The grass is there.
I first met Seamus Sheridan when he came to the Salone del Gusto, which was the very big slow food biannual event. And he, you know, called the international office 2 days before the event started. He had like kind of a car's worth of cheese in the back.
He had a rucksack on his back. Yeah, I remember smelling him.
Yeah, exactly. And I literally got him through the gate.
Yes.
And then he started what ended up being an awesome, you know, history with slow food and, you know, being involved in cheese, their big event. And now tell us about these fishermen. I mean, what waters are they fishing on and what fish are they
bringing
back?
Well, actually, Ballymaloe, where I come from, which means, by the way, the town's land of sweet honey. It's a very ancient name. And that is right beside the sea. Our little fishing village is Ballycotton, right beside us. And so we get the fish that comes in from the boats of Ballycotton. We have fantastic fish around our tiny island, of course, lots of coastline. So we have wonderful fish, cold waters, huge variety of fish and shellfish. And we still have some day boats, so we try to buy the fish from the day boats rather than the boats that are out for several days. So we get, you know, all the flat fish, round fish, and lots of shellfish, you know, lobsters, crabs, all that wonderful things as well, scallops and so on.
Yeah, very, very nice. And so, and then you get a certificate at the end of this course, right? 12-week intensive course.
Yes,
you get
exactly.
A diploma.
Not a diploma. It's called a certificate because you have to do a year. You need to do a year for a diploma. So there are exams, both written and practical. And it's recognized all over the world now, the Ballymaloe Cookery School Certificate.
Have you ever made quindim, the Brazilian dessert, in your school?
Never even heard of it.
No,
so
one
have
ever
to,
does it.
You'll have it's to a, teach me how to do that.
Well, I have no idea, but I know it's my favorite dessert. Well, we're going to take a short break and we're going to come back and learn about this amazing Allen family. It goes back four generations and it has its tentacles and all things sustainable and interesting in Ireland. So we'll take a break and come right back with Doreen Allen.
Everyone is searching hard, gazing out upon the stars, realizing true love's hard to find. Many people won't awake, never making same mistakes, chasing dreams that soon leave them behind.
We're back. I hope you're interested, Jack.
Man. My fingers are busy typing.
Good, good. Well, this is a very interesting family. Doreen Allen is part of a family that goes back four generations, and they're just involved in a lot of things. So this is a really tough question to spring on Doreen, but tell us a little bit about some of the, you know, key players in the family tree, especially let's start with the old guys first, the real starters of
well,
it all.
Well, the real heroine of this piece is Myrtle Allen and Myrtle Allen and my now late father-in-law, Ivan Allen, who had, you know, bought this old country house, rambling country house in 1948 in the middle of a 400-acre farm and and reared their children there. And he was a farmer and had greenhouse and all of that. So when the children had gone to boarding school, they were rattling around in this big house, 16 bedrooms or whatever. Anyway, so Myrtle decided she'd start a little restaurant and just serve the food, write the menu every day, just serve the food that she served to her family and friends. And so anyway, never have more than 20 people, but things got out of hand a bit after a while.
Never have more than 20, that was a rule of hers.
So anyway, so they started that then, and then they had the little country house at home. It was the first in the British Isles. And she, as I said, she just served the kind of food that nobody served in restaurants at that time. It was kind of like family food, but really quite sophisticated, what you serve to your guests if they're coming to dinner party. So anyway, I came to work there from a hotel school. I had done hotel management in Dublin. I'd heard about this woman who, you know, was who was writing the menu every day at a time when in Ireland most people just when they started a restaurant, they wrote the menu, it was the same 10 years later. So and they were using their Jersey cream to make homemade ice cream and thing, all the rest. So anyway, then she has six children, and then now there are four generations, right down to her great grandchildren.
But did she make up her own recipes, or did she call upon Irish history, or were there just things she had
seen
on her travels?
Well, basically, she taught herself gradually how to cook. She couldn't cook at all when she got married, but she was loved mastering art of French cooking, Elizabeth David's, you know, the books as well. So she gradually taught herself how to cook, and she had a very appreciative husband. If you want to cook, you need an appreciative person to eat it.
Was he a portly fellow?
Not really, no. Okay. But he just loved his food, and he, you know, I always say, a lot of women tell me they can't stand cooking, and it's a lot of the time it's because they have to cook, and nobody ever lifts their head out of the plate to say thank you. So I'm always reminding people to give a hug to the cook. But anyway, there's, so now there's four generations, and
how many people have you ever counted the number?
You know,
I
keep meaning to count it, but I think there's over 50 of us or something.
Wow.
But all, we have a whole lot of different businesses under the Ballymaloe umbrella, so to speak, and we all are financially independent of each other. So it's really important in a family that the business are separate. So one of my sister-in-laws has the Ballymaloe shop and a little cafe at the end of the shop.
And what's that? What do they sell, and what she serves?
Well, she sells, really, it's a craft shop, but also a kitchen shop as well. And then wonderful little cafe at the end. Another brother-in-law has one of the grain stores into a wonderful music venue where they can have weddings and, you know, everything from children's playgroups to
whatever.
So it's
like whatever. Catering kind of.
That's a lovely sort of space in one of the grain barns. And then, you know, another sister-in-law makes the Ballymaloe country relish, which all of Ireland is addicted to. And now, it's available over here.
Yeah, it's available here. Yeah. Where can people buy it?
Well, people can buy it. Well, you certainly can buy it in Dean and DeLuca. But there are about 200 other outlets as well. So if you go and look at the website, the Ballymaloe Country Relish website, well, then you'll find out where to get it.
Is relish a big Irish thing?
Not necessarily, but this is a family recipe that's come down to several generations. It's been made in small batches. It's made with really good ingredients, and there's no preservatives or anything. So actually,
is it like a chutney or
relish? It's like a chutney. And it's tomato based, but with spices and so on. It's really good. We were all, you know, brought up in it, and it's just people used to smuggle it into America and Australia, but now you can actually get it here. So that's great. And it's
anything now that it's mass produced?
No, because it's all still made in small batches.
Okay.
And you know, there are no preservatives. And it's fantastic with Irish cheddar cheese, like the Dublin or something like that. It's really good with that.
Now, how did they sell the business to a bigger company,
or do they still
maintain it?
Absolutely not. It's still the family stirring the pots and so on. And this is not a kind of marketing thing. This is what it is. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? But anyway, there's that. And then there's another, a lot of the grandchildren then have also started businesses. Ted, who's married to Roisin, they have something called the Wild Side Catering. He was the first chap in Ireland to do what you called hog roasts or whatever over here.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he goes all over the country doing that and doing catering. And then there's another one of the nephews called Cully, and they have a business called Cully and Sully, where they do ready meals and soups, homemade soups, and it just tastes so wonderfully homemade. And they've won all sorts of young entrepreneur awards and thing, and they've taken over a huge, something like 40% of the soup business in Ireland.
Huh.
And it's made to no preservatives or anything in it, and they've proved that you can make something on a very large scale but still using really good ingredients. And then another one of my son-in-laws, Rupert, married to my daughter Lydia, they have run farmers markets. And actually I was also involved in Ireland in restarting the whole new farmers market movement in Ireland. There are about 160 farmers markets now.
Really? When was the first early ones?
Well,
were like in the 80s?
Yes,
80s?
It was in the let me just think, it's about 17 or 18 years ago. I was over in San Francisco visiting a friend of mine, Mary Risley, who owns Tom Marie's cooking school over there, and I saw a very early farmer's market.
Yeah, not the one at the very
not
plaza.
The one at the
they
very
were
plaza.
Like three blocks
yeah,
up.
The one before that.
Yeah, which had that one cafe where everyone would, like, you'd have to wait
exactly.
2 hours for a coffee.
And
you still do at the very plaza.
Yeah, well, it's fantastic, because I suddenly, you know, I was really worried being from a farm about very often farmers are simply not paid enough for what they produce to produce really good food.
Mm-hmm.
And on one side you had farmers who were desperate to sell their produce locally, and on the other side you had producers who wanted it because a lot of the supermarkets had gone over to a central distribution system, the local farmers couldn't sell to the local shops anymore because they were buying from central distribution. So when I went and saw this market, it was like a light bulb going on, and I thought, well, we have to restart the markets again. And I came back to Ireland and got a little stall and put on my shawl and went into the Coal Quay in Cork, where for 400 years people had been trading there. I was still on television television at the time, much to the amusement of the real Shawleys when they saw me coming in, and they thought it wouldn't last. But I still,
what
if
were
I was
you selling,
organic vegetables and jams and pickles and things.
And you were the only one there?
No. There were about five or six of us who were initially started, including Frank Heatherman, who does that wonderful smoked artisan smoked fish from Bell Valley near Cove, and three or four other of the staff.
How long had it been since that market had been active?
No, that market was active, but it was selling kind of old clothes and not really, food like that. Although we have another wonderful market in Cork called the English Market. So this was a complete revival. And actually, it was really interesting. When I started the farmers markets first, I wrote about it in the Irish Farmers Journal, which is goes down into every lane, every parish in Ireland. And I suggested that this was a great way forward for at least some farmers and so on to get the full amount of money into their hand and to get the credit for what they were doing. And I got hate mail. I got letters from farmers saying, are you really, how dare you insult us? How are you really suggesting that we get back out on a stall and sell off the side of the street? I'd rather be on my knees. You see, because of our history, it was considered to be, you'd want to be on your knees to do that. And then it was very interesting. A lot of real farmers found it very difficult to come into farmers markets. It's changed now. And the next time I wrote about it in the Farmers Journal, I had people writing to me for I did a kit on how to set up a farmer's market and sent it to people. And now they're, and even though in Ireland now the economy is really going through a very challenging time, as you know, but still the farmer's markets and the artists, the food of the artisan food producers and cheesemakers are a lot of the cheesemakers, and they're actually doing as well, if not better, than they were before, because people trust, it's a bond of trust, and people say,
and actually, it's not that much more expensive, you eat a very rich piece of blue cheese, you just need a lot less of it, and I wonder, is commodity food much less expensive than, for instance, the vegetables you would charge?
Not really, but there is a perception probably over here too that farmers' markets are more expensive and so on. But look how much depends on the food we eat. Our food, just to remind ourselves that our food should be our medicine. Instead of buying bottles of and pills and everything else, if we get a lovely, and it doesn't have to be expensive, some lovely potatoes covered in earth, some lovely fresh cabbage, some lovely beans. This is not expensive ingredients, but you have to be able to cook. It's really important to be able to cook, to turn really, doesn't have to be expensive ingredients, into something delicious and nourishing and wholesome.
The only time Americans understand that, if they're hungover, they know that like a steak breakfast or a bacon, egg and cheese sandwich will get them over their hangover faster. Yes. But then they don't apply that to being a little weak. I'm like, eat a hamburger, bacon on it. You'll feel good,
Yes. But this is really so important, because so much of the food we're eating nowadays is empty food. It's not real food. Calories. And it's actually nutritionally deficient. So I'm sure that's what's at the base of the whole obesity problem, that so much of the food we're eating is simply not delivering on nutrients, either for our body or for our mind. Yeah. And it actually makes your mind play tricks as well when you're not getting the proper nutrients.
Yeah, exactly, so, you get hungry right away. Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask, so now when you did this crazy farmer's market, what people deemed was crazy at the time, farmer's market thing, and also as all your family opens all these new businesses, I mean, how do you maintain quality? That you don't have a great-grandchild that comes out with the crappy product. I mean, is there like an internal tasting committee?
Well, when you're brought up in this whole environment, it's not that there's, we all, there's a, it's not about having to reach an expectation. People, it's just the way it is, you just, there hasn't been a problem yet that somebody wanted to sell something that was lesser quality, because we all believe and believe in and know that it has to be quality to be good, basically. And for it, there has to be a USP, and it's not something that's kind of just a marketing thing or whatever. We want people, if you're selling something, it can be just one thing that you're passionate about, and your reputation depends on that as well. So it has to be terrific. And, particularly if you're selling direct, and we have a lot of contact with the people we're selling to, you're looking at them straight in the face and you have a relationship with them. And we all feel so strongly about the importance of food that nourishes, and also of passing on the skills to the next generation and so on, to educational systems with the schools and at the Ballymaloe Cookery School itself.
Well, we've just this has been fascinating so far. We've just looked at the internal history, the kind of Allen blood that is going through the pumping through the Irish sustainable food system. We're going to take a break and come back and talk about Irish history, connection to England, Prince Charles, slow food, Grandmother's Day. So stay tuned, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. It's Sunday. We are the main course. We're sponsored by Fairway Market. We're produced and engineered by Jack Ginsley. I'm Patrick Martins. In studio is Dorina Allen, the Julia Child. Do we have a Julia Child sound effect, Jack?
Oh, man, I should get on that.
Yeah, Julia Child one or Peter Kump.
You just know, like a, maybe just a quick laugh from Julia
James
Child.
Beard, a young, a portly, hefty laugh. So, well, it's been fascinating. I mean, we've covered really a lot. I mean, the cooking school, the hotel, and the whole family history. I mean, this is truly, I mean, the number, they are the Kennedys of Ireland. So, you know, it's a very, very fascinating place to visit and look up on the internet and to read these books. But, of course, the backdrop, for everything that you do on a global level is, you know, that Ireland isn't, it's kind of almost joked about, as is England, you know, for having horrible food and and everything. So just tell us a little bit about the history of Irish cooking, of course, the famine, and, you know, how it's come to be the way it is today.
Well, you know, the thing is that in Ireland, Ireland is now, we call it the food island. And we've always been very fortunate in Ireland to have a high percentage of rich, fertile soil. We're surrounded by water, a little island. So we have a long growing season. We can produce fantastic quality produce. And that's right back from the time they're hunter-gatherers and, you know, they were eating the fish and the shellfish from around the coast and so on, right up to now. And actually, what's happened in a way now, even though things are tough in Ireland, food is one of the main drivers of the economy. So it's always been, we've always had the natural resources, we have the climate to grow really good food.
Well, what do you export?
We export 90% of our beef, a huge percentage of dairy products, a lot of the milk powder from something like 30%, more than 30% of the milk powder from around the world comes from Ireland. And again,
is this also within the EU?
This is, Ireland is in within the EU, yes, but we also export right around the world.
Okay.
And our dairy products as well. And there was butter market in Cork for over 100 years. Where it was the biggest butter market in the world. So food is one of the main drivers of our economy now, and we are blessed, naturally blessed, to produce wonderful produce. So
why is it that there's this bad reputation? I mean, what is it behind? Is it in the poor homes, or is it that the wealthy, or is it that chefs, restaurants have not opened there? Like, what is the kind of
stereotype? Well, basically, there's no doubt about it. There is a sort of perception that we live on corned beef and cabbage and all of that. But what I think, in a way, people cooked their food very simply for many years. They just cooked the simple ingredients that were around them, dependent where you were in the social strata, of course. But also, the perception is of that. But now, in the last 25, 30 years, there's been this incredible renaissance, as I explained to you about the artisan food producers and farmhouse cheesemakers and so on. And then the country was much more affluent. People travelled. We got more confidence in what we were doing. And you have to travel to realise what you have under your own, very often under your own nose, mm-hmm. is terrific quality. So that's all happened. And so now people realize, the word is getting out, that you can come to Ireland not just for the lovely scenery and the friendly people like people used to come for, but now that there really is, do a little homework and you can find fantastically good, real food right around the country.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was just given by a friend an advanced copy of Prince Charles's speech at Georgetown University about the future of food.
Yes.
And, you know, I know he's English or Irish, but I mean, there's a close connection between those cultures. I mean, can you speak a little bit about Prince Charles's kind of like, you know, radical views on anti-corporate?
I'm a big fan of Prince Charles, actually. Now, I've been fortunate to meet him several times and dine with him and so on. So I believe he will be absolutely seen as a visionary. And, you know, for a while, he was kind of slightly laughed at and joked at for thinking he was a little bit flaky about the whole thing. But my goodness, as far as I'm concerned, he ticks all the boxes in terms of, you know, a philosophy that resonates with me. And he's, for many, many years, he doesn't just walk the walk. He doesn't just talk the talk. He walks the walk. He has the farm. He's many, many wonderful projects. So he's really inspirational, Prince Charles.
He is actually the most radical politician in the world. I mean, or, you know, person of figurehead within politics.
Yes,
or whatever,
and he looks at the
it.
Bigger picture as well, and so on. And it's gradually, you know, it's like everything else. It's like water dripping on the stone. It's obvious that what he's been saying over and over again for many years is really an important message for all of us.
For sure. And of course, you know, talking about international movements and figures, I mean, Slow Food, that's where we first met back in, I guess, 1998 or 2000 or something like that.
Yes, at Terra Madre, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So now talk about your Slow Food work, and I know you're big into these educational projects with schools.
Yes, well, I head up Slow Food in Ireland. I've been a member of Slow Food probably as long as you have.
Yeah.
And so we have a convivia at East Cork in Ireland, and we have a Slow Food educational project there where we link in with about nine local schools, all of whom have to have a school garden and a compost heap and everything like that. And so we teach the children how to cook and how to grow, basically. Mm. So what happens is they each, and then we also send, we raise money through the East Cork Slow Food Educational Project. And we send a chicken coop, do you call it a coop, or chicken arc, to every school with two hens in it.
Oh, wow.
So the children can learn how to keep chickens, and the children actually look after the chickens. They feed them scraps from the school lunches and so on, and then collect the eggs, which they take home on a rota basis. And then they clean out the chicken coop and put the manure onto the compost heap. And they know that that activates the compost, and that goes back onto the soil to make, in their little vegetable plots, to make the soil more fertile. So this is all a very important learning thing.
The whole part of your zero waste.
Exactly.
Plan.
Absolutely. And then actually at the cooking school, Ballymore Cookery School, the scraps from the morning's cooking get fed to the hens and come back as eggs a few days later. The students actually, on a rota basis, feed the hens, and then it goes onto the compost heap. So making compost is, it's all about the soil. Good food is all about the soil and about nourishing and feeding the soil. But the East Cork Slow Food Educational Project, the response we get to that from the parents and the kids and the teachers is phenomenal. They come up to the cooking school and we teach them how to cook, and they lay the table and they put little flowers on the table. They go out and pick up the eggs or pull the rhubarb or pick the elderflowers, because we do quite a lot of foraging and encouraging people to eat wild foods and all of that as well. We've been doing that for 15-20 years.
I would never trust myself with the mushrooms. I would always be afraid. Did you ever see that Sean Penn movie where it's just a true story about the poor kid who ate this mushroom and died? I mean, I would.
Yeah, well,
it
is, but you know, I'm not I don't know so much about mushrooms, so I stick to absolutely what I know and so on. So, but it, you know, there's lots of other wild things growing all around us, right through the earth at the moment. There's lots of wild garlic, I think what you call ramps, and then there'll be elderflower in a few weeks' time, and then so right through the year. And we do courses actually on, it's called A Walk on the Wild Side with Dorina Allen.
Oh,
and we've been doing that both in spring and autumn. And you know, years ago when I started doing those 15 or 20 years ago, you know, there were maybe 20 or 30 people on them. Now they're totally oversubscribed every time. And it's really good that people realize the importance of wild foods from a nutritional point of view, because they're foods that haven't been in any way, you know, tampered with, and they have their full complement of vitamins and minerals, and it's what we need at that time of the year. But I have to tell you about the Slow Food Education Project. In one school alone, where we have linked up with, Ballycredden School, in the first year, 20 parents got hens for the first time at home, mm-hmm. and 35 parents started to grow vegetables for the first time. Mm. And that was because the kids came home and said, "Mammy, mammy, mammy." And it's better than that, because with the chickens, two different children from that school started to had their own hens and started to look after, sell the eggs to their parents and their neighbours. So they started, it's also teaching entrepreneurial skills.
Sure.
So that's really important. And that just thrills me when you get that sort of response.
That is awesome. As an entrepreneur, to me, that sounds fantastic. So tell us about Grandmother's Day.
Oh, yeah. This also, a number of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, actually, Alice Waters, who's a wannabe grandmother, and myself, we launched...
A wannabe grandmother.
So she and I feel very strongly about, as many others do, about passing on the skills. And often, grandmothers like myself, we have... you know, to a certain extent, we're guardians of a certain amount of inherited wisdom at this stage. So we have there's an international Slow Food Grandmother's Day. It's on the 21st of April. So on that day, we encourage grandparents all around the world, and in our case in Ireland as well, to gather their grandchildren around them if they're close to them. And on that day, particularly, show them how to cook or how to grow something. Granddads can be involved as well. And just passing on the skills. And it's a very special bond between grandparents. Sure. Grandchildren. So it's lovely to nurture that. And also, of course, years ago, people automatically learned how to cook and everything else by, you know, from one generation to another. Now that has been broken for several generations. And as a result, a lot of our young people are really almost helpless. They've left themselves, you know, they concentrate on a set of academic skills, which are considered to be of more value in the educational system in many of our countries.
They're not using their hands.
Then life skills or life skills and cooking skills. And so what happens is, if you lose your job, and if you can be a lawyer or whatever, and suddenly you can't make yourself you can't make a little omelette or a spontaneous pasta or a bowl of porridge. So we must, as parents and grandparents, we mustn't let any more of our little dotes out of our houses without equipping them with these life skills.
My mother wanted me to become able to read music. So she's like, then you go to any bar and you play these old songs and they'll pay you thousands of dollars in a week. So,
but you have to be able to eat. You can survive without being able to play music, which is fantastic, but you have to be able to nourish yourself.
As well.
Yeah, otherwise you're finished.
I guess she knew I couldn't cook, so that's why she said, get a job at a bar, you know, then you can eat. Now, can you give us a St. Patrick's Day recipe, even though it's just missed when people search the website? And, of course, St. Patrick's and some of the traditions are for the general time period.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be only on the 15th.
Well, I was last night I was invited by lovely Mona Talbot, whom you may know.
Mona Talbot. She's in charge of the cooking school in Rome, right?
Well, she used to be at the American Academy in Rome. She's here in Brooklyn now.
Okay.
And I came and I brought some Irish white flour and wholemeal flour, and she had some buttermilk and a bit of cream, and I made a loaf of soda bread in a couple of minutes. So let me tell you how quick it is. You can make it in America. This is soda bread.
Okay.
So basically, next time you need some bread, instead of, you know, finding your car keys to go down to the local shop, you turn on the oven. You get a nice big bowl and you put into it a pound of flour. It could be a mixture of wholemeal flour or white flour, and put that in. Put a teaspoon of salt, a teaspoon of bicarbonate of soda or baking soda, and run your hands through it to make sure it's well mixed. Make a little well in the center. Pour in about 16 fluid ounces of buttermilk. I put a dash of cream into it if it's a low-fat buttermilk, because a lot of it is over here. And then make your hand into a claw with your fingers outstretched like that, and then stir it in a full circular movement. All the milk in, buttermilk in, and then by the time you get to the outside of the bowl, the bread is made. A little bit of flour on the worktop, turn it out, form it into a round, pat it out about an inch and a half thick, and then cut across. That's the traditional blessing. And then you prick it in the four corners to let the fairies out of the bread. Because if you don't let the fairies out of the bread, the fairies will jinx your bread and it won't be good. And so you pop it into the oven at about 450, turn it down after 10 minutes or so, and leave it in for another 30 minutes. And take it out, put it on a wire rack, cool it, break it in the center and cut it from the thing and slather it with good Irish butter
salted butter.
Oh my God, how good is that? It's the easiest way to win friends and influence people.
We've just Jack has just left the building. He's making soda bread.
I had to go turn my oven on. Yeah,
yeah, you were back. Thank God you live right outside.
Yeah, you wouldn't be back from the shops by the time it's out of the oven.
What an amazing show. Dorina, can you give us a website, your favorite website for how people can learn and visit and Google?
Well,
and
basically www.cookingisfun.ie or ballymaloo.com will get you, you know, and each of the websites are linked into each other.
You can also just search Dorina Allen. That's the easiest to spell. There's no silent letters in that. Yeah. It's D-A-R-I-N-A.
That's right.
And Allen, A-L. Yeah. L-L-E-N. And it is just a fun website to look to because it has links to what all the kids are doing, all the grandparents, all the history. You see pictures. And what a fun place to visit.
And if people are in the area, if they're in Ireland, they can just pop in for an afternoon's cookery class.
Yeah.
And our gardens are open to the public. They can wander around the organic farm and stuff as well. We'd love to see them.
We'll tag your cell phone number so everyone can just call direct. No, just kidding. We don't have, Jack does not have your cell phone number.
It's okay.
But this has been a fantastic interview. Thank you so much. Now you're going to kindly sign my Irish traditional cooking book, which has just been released. It's over 300 recipes from Ireland's heritage. And this is what Alice has to say about the book on the cover. Dorina Allen's beautiful and unpretentious vision of cooking is connected to the land, its seasons, and to the artisan producers. I find this book important and irresistible. So go to your bookstore and buy it. Dorina, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
We'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.